Accession number 9168, rule number 18.
Mr. Amat, reel 18.
These natives, through these bottles containing petrol and onto the armoured cars, and they caught, there was two motorcycles, as I said, used to go with these, and these two were caught in this, and the whole business, apparently, I wasn't there, as I say, but it happened after I'd left the area, that the two motorcyclists were actually burned to death on their cycles. The armoured cars eventually got out of it after the natives of one of the other native unit had rushed the rioters and got them out of the way. And I don't think any of the crews of the armoured cars were hurt, but the two motorcyclists were burned to death on their machines. That's the sort of thing that used to happen in those days in these riot-ridden places.
What were relations like with the natives in your camp? Did you have bearers?
Oh, yes, we had them. In those days, all the British Army was, as I say, treated like gods, and everybody, whoever low in rank, had a servant. And these people, bearers we used to call them, they'd you weren't supposed to do any work at all. When you woke up in the morning, or even before you woke, a native come along with a large urn thing with hot water in it, and he had a shaving brush and soap, and he'd soap your face and shave you even while you were still asleep, and turn your face over each way, and sometimes you'd wake up and find you'd already been shaved. And then you'd hear a jangle of mugs and cups, and you'd find the charwala, that's the tea man, come round with the hot tea, place it on your kit box, which is at the bottom of your bed. And then your bearer had come in, or would probably come in at the same time as the, I forget the name of the chap who used to shave us. Anyway, come in about that early and take all your equipment and your tunic and everything outside on the veranda, and there he'd clean all the buttons and polish all the brasses of your uniform, and generally you get you ready for parade. And all you had to do was get up and go and have a shower or a wash and come back and get into your uniform, and you were all ready for parade. And when you come off parade, you just simply throw your equipment down and take off your tunic and uniform, and the bearers come in and collect it all and take it out on the veranda, and any washing that was your vest and pants and all that, you take away and to the dobie, that was the name of the people, the men who used to wash the clothes. And by the evening or early next morning, your clothes had all come back, all cleaned, so everything was done for you. It was it used to be called a soldier's paradise, India, and it was in those days, but it was we only got this from our previous the previous British Army people out there, but they were even better treated than us, I think. But some of the units, especially the infantry units, the colonels and the officers commanding, were rather disgruntled about this idea. And some of the units didn't allow any bearers onto their establishment at all. And all the soldiers were expected to do the same as they do or did in this country, and that's look after themselves and keep their uniforms clean and do their own washing and all that sort of thing. So we were rather lucky, because all the time I was out in India, we had bearers and dobies and dirzies, that's the people who do the tailoring, and all those things used to be looked after. So it was really quite a life of pleasure, and when I was out there anyway. the natives out there, as I say, a lot of them were engaged on servants of the British Army, but all the other natives I saw out there were very poor, and in the villages around surrounding a garrison cantonment, there was very great privation, I think, amongst the people, because they'd the only heat they used to get was from a fire made from the dung of their cattle, and this used to be dried on the roofs of their huts, and it was very usual to see them collecting this during the day, and at night they'd start a fire going just inside their huts, and that's the only heat they had. And the only food they had was, of course, nearly all rice and very little meat. And a lot of them suffered with all sorts of diseases, and you could see them sitting outside their huts sometimes with great sores on their legs and arms. A lot of them had that disease which we used to call elephantitis, where one of your limbs swells up to enormous size and takes on a very similar to an elephant's leg. And there's no doubt that the natives did suffer a lot, but of course, as they'd been like that for centuries, I suppose they didn't notice it. But of course, we, in our civilised society, we realised the difference between the natives and the life we used to live.
Did the natives feel any resentment towards you?
No, at that time, no. The natives were very, how should I put it? I won't say close, but they accepted they were resigned to their fate, as it were, and they accepted the fact that we were the masters and we were to be looked up to, and they'd salam and sort of grovel to us, and were really treated like not necessarily our fault, second-class citizens. They had no material rights at all. And the hierarchy of the old native settlements in those days was each garrison had what was called a babu, and that was a high-ranking, well, not necessarily high-ranking, but very rich Indian person, and he controlled the whole of the destiny of the old area of the natives. And when a regiment changed over and a new regiment came in, this babu would present himself to the colonel of the regiment and explain who he was and ask what the colonel wanted of him and all the servants he controlled. We'd say he's the man who was virtually a king of the whole of the local population. He used to run the canteen, the troops canteen. He used to run all the people who were servants to the troops, the bearers and the water carriers, and all the people who worked in the barracks were controlled by this one man. And each one of these people had to pay a subsidy to this babu, otherwise they didn't get the job to come in the cantonment. So that he used to sit there and take the money from all these people, so much a month, I think they used to pay him. And everything, right down to gardeners and the men who come and shaved you and give you the tea and all that sort of thing, was all controlled by this one man. And he used to fit the officers up with the bungalows, in elaborate bungalows. They were in their own grounds with about a dozen servants for each officer, and everything that went with it, all the produce from round about, was all controlled with this, what we call a babu.
Were you encouraged to treat the Indians as second-class citizens?
Oh yes, you were not. it was an unwritten law that if one of your bearers or any of the servants didn't come up to scratch, you just simply booted him up the backside and told him one or two home truths that you thought about him if he didn't come up to scratch. But I don't think none of our chaps, they were more sort of modernised than the previous old English soldier, and I don't think any of our chaps used to take that advantage too much. There was one or two who did, but we used to raise our voices at them and point at them and threaten them with all sorts of destruction, but I don't think anybody really raised their hand or foot to do any damage to them. But that was enough, really, because they used to cow down and they'd sort of mend their ways a bit.
What language did you speak with the Indians?
Oh, yes, the Hindustani was the old British soldier's idea of Hindustani, anyway. Was handed down from generation to generation of the British Army out there. And it was a sort of, it was Hindustani up to a point, but it was adapted so that a British soldier could understand more or less what he wanted done or what he wanted to say. But we used to hold classes in language in languages, and although Hindustani was spoken, the Urdu, that's another Indian language, and Pashto, that's another language that was spoken on the frontier amongst the Pathans. By the way, the Pathans was a very warlike tribe that originated out on the frontier but was recruited by the British Army and formed the nucleus of security guards for the rest of the Indian population. Great big men, about 6'6", and with huge swords and knives stuck in their belt and looking very fierce. Anyway, the...
You were talking about the language.
Oh, yes, yeah. Urdu. And yeah, we started classes, and one of the tutors used to come along, invariably an Indian, and he'd teach you to speak and write in either Hindustani or Urdu. And I remember one of our chaps here, a Scotsman, he took up Pashto, which is a frontier language, because it was very handy, though, because if you could speak one of the dialects of the frontier, you were more or less unmolested. You could go out on your own, and you could, with impunity, more or less, and you get quite a... you could get some all sorts of things from the natives that you wouldn't otherwise... they wouldn't have otherwise have come your way. But, as I say, the British soldier picked up this Hindustani very quickly, and we used to chant it to one another in the barrack room, so after about 6 months, nearly every soldier knew more or less how to ask for things and how to deal with the natives and tell them what to do and all that sort of thing, you see. And we knew the monetary system, the rupees, and... by the way, the rupees in those days was all silver, and it was a coin about as big as a half a crown of Indian silver, and each one of these rupees was worth 16 annas, and there was each one of the annas was divided into another 16 parts, and they were called pice. And each one of the pice was divided into 12 parts, and they were called pi. Well, pi, the very minimal coinage, well, one coinage, they were shells, little tiny shells that were picked up in various places. And if you had 12 of those, you could get a pi, a pice. Well, a pice was about as big as a farthing. So you can just imagine the... small monetary system that went on amongst the poorer natives. had to be like that because, as I say, the natives were so poor that you got down to bartering a few small shells for something you wanted to eat or drink or something you wanted to use. Anyway, that's part of the monetary system. But the language, you soon picked it up, and we more or less used to speak it to one another. And we had a sort of a pidgin industry. We used to throw about in the barrack room, and instead of speaking normally like soldiers would at home, we'd speak to one another half Hindustani and half English. It was more or less, you learnt it right from the beginning as soon as you got out to India. You soon got into the habit of getting yourself understood.
Was the caste system much in evidence?
Oh yes, yeah, the Indians, as I say, the Babu was the chief in charge of all of the servants around any cantonment. But the caste system itself was very rigorously maintained. And I don't know which is the highest hierarchy, but you take the Raja, would, as far as I can remember, is one of the highest castes, and then you went right the way down, you see, and right down through the system. And each one of these castes was not allowed to intermingle or intermarry with one of a lower class. So if you belong to one class, you never got out of it. You never got any higher, or you never dropped any lower. It's all according to what you were born in. And each one of these castes was had a denoting mark, usually on their forehead or some part of their body, with a coloured dot or some sort of a symbol, which each one of them could recognise, but we didn't know anything about. They knew which class they belonged to. For instance, the lowest form of humanity out there amongst the Indians was the bearer's dhobi, and that was the man who swept the floor and done all the menial tasks and cleaned out the latrines. He had a man who did his washing, and he was the lowest caste of the lot. So, and it went up from there, you see. So, and very complicated, but you soon got used to the how to tackle all that sort of thing. Well, one of the things I'd like to record while I was out there was earthquakes. The first time I come in contact with earthquake was when I was at Kanspur on the Murray Hills. The first time I went up the hills on the, it was 1923, and I was taken ill one day, and they took me on a stretcher up the hills to a hospital. And I only stopped there a couple of days, but the first night we was there, I didn't know at the time, but I felt the bed shaking. I saw the lights swaying overhead in the bungalow, and one of the chaps who was there, a corporal in one of the infantry regiments, he said, oh, I hit one of them earthquakes again. And quite frightening, really, because something I'd never experienced before. But after that, I experienced several earthquake tremors. And I know for sure we had several. We were in the earthquake zone there. But that's why the buildings were built in those days by the British Army to withstand all that. The walls were about 4 feet thick, and they were treble banked. In other words, there was an inner shell, and then there was an outer shell, which was a little bit less thick. And then there was a veranda beyond that on either side and all round the end. So the building had a very good chance of standing upright, irrespective of what the shock was. All the other lesser buildings, though, and the native huts would come tumbling down during these quakes.
You yourself were promoted to corporal. Could you give me some idea of your daily duties once you were a corporal?
Yeah, well, when I was promoted corporal, I more or less took charge of the section because I don't know why it was, but there was always seemed to be, well, I know our sergeant, he was, he'd been run over with an armoured car, his foot was injured, and he was off sick, so we had no sergeant, and there were no other person of any rank available, so I had to take charge of the section. And although I was only a corporal, I was supposed to be doing a sergeant's job, and I had several lance corporals under me, and about 28 or 30 troops. And we used to take me my place with these sergeants on the on our drills and all that. And I was when we used to go out on, for instance, I went out on reconnaissance several times. I don't know if I mentioned it before, but in India you get the monsoon. Well, a monsoon comes usually about June or July, according to what part of the country you're in, across the Western Ghats, and torrential rain lasts for about 3 or 4 months. And the rainwater is such a volume that the whole of the landscape changes, because the normal channels that carry the normal rivers in normal times can't cope with the volume of water. So new channels are cut through, new ground altogether. So every now and again, the Army institute a reconnaissance to do a series of map reading, map planning and plotting, so as to get your maps right with the existing geography. And I went on one or two of these, and I remember we used to take a couple of armoured cars, a 30 underweight lorry and a motorbike, and I'd go out with the OC had come, a lieutenant, not normally any more than a lieutenant, was sometimes only a second lieutenant, just come out from England. And he'd go out with our maps of the existing ground as it was before, and we'd plot various points, trig points, so that we could get an idea of the layout of the, and we'd make sketches. What they call field sketches of the ground we covered, and then send it up with the map and any comments we used to make to the people who made the maps up in Simla. Well, I know one particular time we went out and we had to re-map a large area of low-lying ground where there was canals had been dug. And these canals were dug by natives, I suppose, and run by the engineers, the British engineers out there in the British Army. And they were straight as a die. You could look along the banks of one, and as far as your eye could see, was one straight line of water, about 20 feet wide and about 10 feet deep. And every now and again, you'd find you'd get a crossing where you had to cross from one side of the... There was a road run along one side, and you have to cross over and get onto the other side because of whatever geographical alterations have been made. And we used to spend about a week on these jobs. It's very interesting, really, because it was a good job I'd had, the education I'd had before in the Army about map reading and science of trigonology and all that sort of thing, and we were able to remap the whole area and bring it back and get it reprinted. We used to take part in several manoeuvres during the early part of each year, and I remember one year we went out on manoeuvres, and I was in the leading armoured car of the column, and we crossed over a bridge near Lahore, and over a very wide river. And there's quite a lot of native traffic about. And of course, the natives in those places, especially the farmers, used to use bullock carts. And these old bullock carts used to come along, usually two abreast on a cart, and they'd only do about 2 or 3 miles an hour, and their heads would be swaying from right to left and pulling this old cart along. Anyway, we got through, and I took my section 2 or 3 miles beyond the bridge, and then one of our motorcyclists roared up and signaled for me to stop, and he said that there'd been an accident behind at the bridge we'd just crossed, and I was told to go back and report to the OC. Anyway, I turned the car around, or got the driver to, and raced back, and when I got to the bridge, I found that the iron railings across the footpath was all broken down, and when I looked over the edge, there was one of our armoured cars upside down on the sandbank side of the river, wheels in the air, one or two people milling around, and there was an officer laying on the ground. And when I got down through the bank and got down to the scene there, I found this officer was actually jumped. What had happened is the driver had seen one of these bullock carts coming in front of him, and in order to avoid it, he pulled over to the left, and he wasn't going very fast, but fast enough, and he jabbed his foot, which he thought was on the foot brake, so that was on the accelerator. Well, of course, you can't, with a Rolls Royce 40, 50 horsepower, you can't do that and get away with it, and the car leapt up and went right over the railings, over the bridge, and turned upside down, landing on its turret. And anyway, the OC came down, and we got this officer and put him on a stretcher, and we found he got a broken back. And got one of the medical people came up and examined him, and he said he was probably dead. So we had to cart him back and take him back to the headquarters. But we carried on with our manoeuvres, and I don't think there was anything else happened during that time. But the point that I'd like to make is that we were always taught that if out in India, if you were in an armoured car or any military vehicle and you saw one of these bullock carts coming towards you, you weren't to deviate to the left or right. You've got to go straight ahead. And although you can put your brakes on and shut your armoured doors, even if you hit it would be better than pulling over to the left or right.